Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today my guest is John Barth, whose new novel, Coming Soon, is published by Houghton Mifflin. John Barth is my favorite living American writer. His masterpieces include The Floating Opera, The Sotweed Factor, Lost in the Funhouse, Letters, The Tidewater Tales. The list goes on and on. I attended his classes when he was teaching at the State University of New York at Buffalo, and he shaped my aesthetic sense. Last week, we began a discussion of his career. Now we enter, in a sense, the terra incognita, because for Barth's first 5-6 books, enormous attention was paid to these books. It grew book by book, and you only needed to look at the next Barth book to find the answers to the questions the previous books had raised. Suddenly, though, new things started to occur in the books that fascinated me because, you know, I felt capable of going to the terror when suddenly books by twinned pairs of able and inept narrators began to arrive, and they didn't seem to carry with them, to my mind, the baggage, say, of Flaubert's thoughts about Bouvard and Pécuchet. These were not satires of the bourgeois. There was suddenly a fascination with how life should not be lived and not be narrated. I'm thinking now of the comparison between Perseid and Bellerophon, between the hero of Sabbatical, a first-time non-writer, and Peter Sagamore, the hero of the Tidewater Tales. It seems to me that suddenly you were in a solar system of your own because book reviewers tend to review one book, and these books could not be perceived fully until they were placed against one another. And so revelations would occur that remain, it seems to me, that the second half of your career remains uncharted and unchartered.
Okay. I suspect that the homely accounting for the phenomenon you just mentioned, I'm not sure yet because it took me by such surprise that it's a characteristic that I will agree with after I've had a chance to think about it. But as a working hypothesis, I suspect it's simply that after the letters novel, that formidable long project written at a kind of midlife time for my muse, meant to be my U.S. bicentennial book when the country was starting its next centennial, etc., that in the intricated patterns of that letters novel, which did a kind of review of an extension of the books that had preceded it, whether it was a good idea or not is another question, but it was what my muse was occupied with for 7 years. I think I rather felt that I had at that point exhausted the material that had gone before and up to and into that book and wanted to do something a little different. That little different involved coming back to a kind of present time, coming back to a geography that I had largely sailed away from for a while, to see how it would play in the new key of my increased years by that time.
Well, it seemed to me that after When Sabbatical came out, I thought, well, he deserves a sabbatical.
I think the muse felt the same thing.
You see, that's when I began to sense that there was a decision, conscious or otherwise. A decision doesn't have to be conscious, does
no.
it?
No, I hope not. In fact, it's often retrospective that we see this is a decision.
That you know, that the book would be narrated, spoken by someone who doesn't know a lot about narrative, a kind of vacation from sophistication, that the book would be about a vacation, that the book, I mean, and this is something, again, that seems to me to be deeply moving. But the book deals with the decision whether or not to have a child late in life. And the result of that decision is that the wife in question, who will not have had a child in her life, becomes the co-narrator of the book, and in every book thereafter.
In there, it's literally a first person, not plural, but a first person dual, right? It's a we narrator who's a two-party antecedent. Yeah.
The books are envisioned as the creation of a male and a female. They are their children for whatever good or bad it does. You know, children are not always a blessing.
That's right.
And these children are various in their effect. But it seemed magnificent. I don't know of anyone who's gone beyond radical subjectivity in the first person to dual radical subjectivities simultaneously. In that book, Sabbatical, a very complicated Vietnamese verse form is described, one discovered or at least analyzed by the poet John Balaban, but I sensed that you were evolving in that book the form of narration which would involve enormous care in dialogue, in mirroring of who speaks where and to who, and that because of that, it's presented as an apprentice book, that you're learning
I like that.
To speak double speak.
I accept that rationalization of what I'm doing immediately, or what I was doing immediately. There is a way, it ought to be said, in which that applies not only retroactively through my books, but through any author's books who is preoccupied, as I am, with the metaphor of the muse. You know, I always speak of the muse in those early books as well, and when I'm talking about it. So in a sense, sometimes the muse is Plato, Aristotle's sense of the muse. Sometimes it's my Scheherazade figure. But notice that in all those cases, traditionally the muses are all female on Mount Helicon or Mount Parnassus or wherever they're hanging out at the time. It is Scheherazade who is my icon and not Shahryar or any of the male narrative figures we might have invoked from old literature. So there's always been that sense of the in this case, a male writer collaborating with a female inspirer. And after all, the classical formula is sing, O muse, not help me sing, which, although that's literally what's the case, the poet is asking the muse to sing through him in the case of the traditionally male bardic poets. So what happens in the Sabbatical novel, and one way or another in the books that follow, is a literalization to one degree or another of what had always been the figurative state of affairs.
You're listening to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and I'm speaking to probably my greatest hero, author John Barth. We're in a sense, discussing the turning points of these fictions that go from being single-voiced to double-voiced. And it, as I have suggested, so many new ideas enter with the possibility of double-voicedness that the critical community, who perhaps at one time inspired you by observations about heroic patterns, etc., and American naive existentialism, I think they trail behind you now in a certain way, that the ideas that you're bringing to the very narratives of these books are so thrilling and unfamiliar.
Well, then you must go ahead then and account while we're here and have a few minutes left for what the critics have in their inattention failed to do, Michael, and give us now the quick shot on how the traditional single narrator with muse becomes the dual narrator, and a category of that is worth getting on the table that goes back to all the old frame stories where from Scheherazade, from the Ocean of Story, from Boccaccio and the rest, you have one voice which is the narrator of the frame and then other voices which are the narrators of the individual tales. Well, where you have maybe dual or even multiple narrators.
I will do better still, and I promise, that with letters and book narrated by relatives of and descendants of and versions of all of the other narrators of Barth's books. So, you know, I have to tell you that if you love to read and you've loved books and you have the naive desire to meet the friends you've known before or find out what happened to them, a very foolish need, but very great need. It's like knowing family. Letters provided seven previous Barth narrators. What follows then is that, astonishingly, in Tidewater Tales, having all of the previous Barth narrators floating through letters, in Tidewater Tales, other narrators, Homer, Don Quixote, figures from other books come and arrive and tell their book.
All my navigation stars, that's right.
Yes, and they tell reorchestrated versions of their stories. To my mind, with such, your Homer, that cave, my breath was taken away. I mean, the Odyssey is the Odyssey, but to have in the middle of a novel. Now, of course, everything in Barth is predicted by something before in Barth, and so the Gilesgoat boy had the entire version of Oedipus Rex told in heroic couplets. But here we've got the telling of the Odyssey, how it came to be told. Then, isn't it natural if other characters are visiting Barth's books, for Barth himself to visit other books? And so, in The Last Voyage of Somebody the Sailor, a Barth character swims into Arabia, and on alternate nights compares, essentially, his ongoing story, much of which he's forgotten, with the story of Sinbad the Sailor, another retelling. Also an exercise in dual voices, but there an exercise in dual male voices, and from the wings, in a sense, you get the stories of mothers, especially one, Haida, is that how you say her name? Female narrations of gestation and birth and learning sexual adeptness that seem to join all of the narrative concerns previously about how the telling of a tale is the pleasure of the sexual experience, is the pleasure of birth and death, the effort to make everything metaphorically a mirror of everything else, so that coincidence is literally the subject of the works. And so it's, as I'm trying to suggest, news about life, because we all, if we are creatures of our culture and love the culture, are creatures created by life and books,
by
stories
life and
events.
For sure, and our experience of art as well as our experience of life.
And so what I was calling terror before is this meeting place of art and life, which the books take on the investigation of. So what was once that state of giddiness described by you as terror, or by the romantic ironists as romantic irony, suddenly we're in a new terrain for fiction itself, the meeting place of tale and teller, of event and reflection of event, which is story, and that this, yes, leans to a complexity which I believe, in On With the Story, involves the invention of the universe. We hear by the last story how the universe could not help but be invented because of the nature of the combustion of energy and imagination that occurs in tale-telling.
Yes, that is somebody's point of view by the time we get to the end of the frame of On With the Story. My flirtation with cosmology, with modern cosmology, and with quantum mechanics, which I went to the way, who was it, Coleridge or Keats, who went to Cavendish's chemistry lectures to replenish his source of metaphors. For me, reading The Sciences in Scientific American and listening to my scientific sons is a way of replenishing my source of metaphors. So while I know zilch about quantum physics, I did find in quantum mechanics lovely sources of metaphor for the kind of thing we're talking about, including just such a homely and debased idea by this time as Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, that the more you know about one aspect of a thing, the less you know about the other. And among those pseudo or semi or quasi technological or scientifical curiosities, I would add that business of the sense of self, indeed the definition of self as a narrative function. You know, I'm sure, Daniel Dennett's theory of consciousness. He's a self-styled neurophilosopher at Tufts University. And other neurophilosophers, including my son, the professor of at University of Colorado, shake their heads a little bit at Dennett. But for us writers, he gives a marvelous account of the analogy between what we do every day for a living and why we read books and why we write books, and the way we go through life. For Dennett, the brain has evolved into a kind of ficting factory or scenario-making machine just to make sense out of the stream of the unending stream of multiple sense data impinging on our senses all the time. So even, not only we, but other animals as well. I mean, this is an enemy, flee, fight, feed, make love, whatever. For Dennett, marvelously for me, here's a metaphor for you, the self is nothing more than a positive center of narrative gravity. I love that phrase, a positive center of narrative gravity. We are, says Dennett, we literally are the stories that the we, meaning the antecedent of that pronoun, we literally are the stories we tell ourselves about who and others about who we are, not in the boastful way, let me tell you, but the way in which we say, gee, Michael, I haven't seen you for a long time, what you've been up to, and I'll tell you what I've been up to. And that we are finally, says this take on neuropsychology, nothing more than that center of narrative gravity, because we're always putting it in the form of a story, even if it's a deer saying, looks like hunter, instincts say flee, hunter, walk another two steps, etc.
Not only we are what we eat, but we are what we read, because what we right. read is a version of the story we are telling ourselves.
And of course some of us devour literature, so we are what we eat in that sense.
I picked up Barth's last book, On With a Story, subtitled Stories, and discovered as I came to its two-thirds mark that it's a novel.
Well, it's an aggregation, let's say.
In which there is a story described by Barth that many people think is, in fact, accomplished by a story called The Menelaiad in Lost in the Funhouse. But I think this description was a prediction of the book On With a Story, to write a story in which seven stories are all climaxed.
All embedded one within the other up to a certain point.
And then the last story climaxes all of them and itself and ends the book and opens the universe.
That's right. Those are, for a change, more or less discrete stories, more or less individual stories set within a frame that reverberates, that gives them a resonance they wouldn't have otherwise. But because I am congenitally a novelist, in my earlier attempts at doing short stories such as Lost in the Funhouse, it was a matter of having written two or three and then with my novelist's reflex beginning to connect the dots and see what other dot would make this into a pattern. The Lost in the Funhouse book and the Chimera trio of novellas really do add up to a book, I think, of whose component parts are integral to, they really are component of the whole. Here the stories were most of them at least, really were written innocently as separate stories with no thought of relation until I thought of the frame. Then they began, of course, one begins to see echoes where one had not thought they were. Sometimes you go back and put an echo in so that it could reverberate later. Writers cheat in both directions time-wise. So that it would add up to a whole, maybe a little more than the sum of its parts, but whose integral, but whose component units certainly don't have either the utter integrality of chapters in a novel, nor the innocent and pleasing discreteness of genuinely separate stories in a collection.
And now we are up to the current Barth work, which, fortunately, amalgamates and incorporates many of the aspects we've spoken of so far, in that this book is, among its narrators, are two, an experienced one and an amateur, who sometimes impersonate one another in a spirit of rivalry, in a spirit of revenge, in a spirit of rascality, and in addition, sometimes at least one of them imagines that he's in collaboration with the other. The book is equally a collaboration of two kinds of novels, a conventional page novel and an electronic novel. It begins with a menu, and the printing of the very word menu is me and you. So that we're throughout...
In English.
We're throughout making distinctions between selves that are in the process of blurring and losing themselves. And everywhere they look, they see possibilities for the continuation of their story. They're so eager for the story to continue that they may not even think whether there's a sequential reason. This book truly explodes into crackers and bits and attempts to come together and then falls apart again and recombines. So that pleasure of not knowing where, who, and what you are and who's talking to you, that pleasure, which I describe as distinctly Barthes, is the whole of this novel.
As long as it remains a pleasure, you know, is when it's described that way, immediately you think, oh God, postmodernism at its postest. And can make, as one of the narrator's remarks in there, can make one long for a story that just tells itself without ever forever reminding us that it's words on paper. But it's been my curse and characteristic from the beginning, will I, nil I, to try to have it both ways with that sort of thing. And so, yes, once again, we have a narrative in which the novelist aspirant, the e-novelist, may be writing this. He may be like a computer virus taking over the voice and eating the files of the so-called novelist emeritus character who may be writing his last book or his next last book. They end up trying to race to get there first with either a P novel or an E novel, while, of course, the apocalypse is coming or may be coming, Y2K and the millennium, depending on how you count your Gregorian centuries and millennia, is maybe coming soon. All this on a showboat gently sinking on a shoal somewhere in Chesapeake Bay, while the last hurricane of the season, one of the last hurricanes of the season, is headed toward it. There's a collaboration for you, all right, in which the other two partners are factuality or pseudo-factuality and fiction. I've had many, 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 many students in my years as a teacher, proteges and that I've had the honor to coach, who've been terrific. Nothing ever resembling the situation in this novel, of course, and nothing ever resembling the rivalry, not to say the sometimes malicious attempt to kneecap, sabotage, or otherwise slow down the competition. So it was fun to imagine that in this book. In the end, of course, I hope you would agree, Michael, it doesn't matter whether this is the mentee's opus or the mentor's opus.
What's magnificent, it seems to me, in the book is that distinctions are at first made. There'll be a person and his opposite double. But the opposite double will have an opposite double, and then that opposite double will have a twin. And they'll
sounds
be,
vertiginous, doesn't
it? You think, in fact, you see, I think, this is not a feeling shared by my culture, that the experience of going crazy in a work of fiction is a pleasure, while the experience of falling apart is not.
In the world,
in the
not.
World.
No fun.
And yes, and so these books imitate an experience that you would not want to have outside them, but are truly, what is the word, exuberating?
If it isn't, it wasn't, it is now.
within them. And you keep noticing new things. The metaphor here is that the container is the contained, And although there are distinctions, they are both in fact the same, in the same way that we have two hemispheres of the brain, and they are the brain. And that the book is meant finally to say, well, maybe Y2K did come. Maybe this is. Maybe we are in hell, you know, or heaven, or both. What matter does difference make?
Yes, what difference does difference make? What can I add to that, Michael? The three exclamation points, perhaps, that end the title of Coming Soon.
What do they do?
The three exclamation points, among their simple functions, is to warn us that we are in the presence of pseudo-overhype, that we're in the presence of hype-hyped, but aware of itself as being hype-hyped, so that we can get on with the story, which, after all, finally is about growing old and being perhaps happily supplanted as we are by our children, let's say, by our offspring, by the writers who come after us and so forth, of knowing that that has been a fruitful experience, though, like having children, one that always advances us towards our own finale. It's been about the experience. It's also a love story, a dual love story, and about the experience of revisiting ideas, concepts, metaphors, images, and physical places that we have had the good luck to have our imagination informed by in previous go-rounds. The paradoxical name of the completely imaginary showboat in this Coming Soon novel is the original Floating Opera 2, and of course the contradiction in that title applies to the book as well. This is the original Floating Opera 2.
As does the idea within the book that the final book of the New Testament will join the first book of the Old, Genesis, and they both begin in catastrophe. The flood at the beginning or the apocalypse at the end, they're both beginnings.
That's right, and beginnings which we may hope, like Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, are the first half of a sentence that the last half of we read when we first opened page one of the novel.
I've been speaking with great pleasure to John Barth, the author most recently of Coming Soon, a Narrative. Thank you very much for joining me.
Michael, I've been listening with at least equal pleasure.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. Special assistance from Alan Howard. You've been listening to Bookworm. I'm grateful for the help of Chip Borton from Albuquerque. We've been taping in the library of the Lannan Foundation at a special and, believe me, longed for, long last meeting between John Barth and I, and me.
And me.
Teacher. You've been listening to Bookworm. Thank you for joining us.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse. Wow.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.